Assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. Gadadhar Pandit ki jai. Bhakti Vinod Thakur ki jai. Gaur Pranam.
Mandeham Shri Guru Shri Tapatam Shri Guru Vaishnavams Cha Shri Rupam Sarvajatam Sadhana Raghunatam Bhutam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadrutam Parijana Saita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sadhana Laitam Shri Vishakam Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda
Jai
Jai Shri Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Jai Jai Chandra Jai Gaura Bhakta Vrinda So I'm going to read from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, chapter 19, reading from text 136 to 138, and we're going to talk about spiritual and material evolution, or how to achieve your real desires, and we're also, of course, going to talk about Gadadhar Pandit and Bhakti. So text 36, do you remember last time what we talked about? A whole long week ago. So long ago. Last Sunday, what was happening in Chaitanya Charitamrita? Rupa Goswami was talking about being empowered.
Talked about empowerment? Remember that? Yes? No? Maybe?
We were sleeping through it? Okay. And now Chaitanya Prabhu is responding to Rupa Goswami. So Rupa Goswami is speaking about Lord Chaitanya's mercy and how although he was the lowest among men, still he was empowered. So Chaitanya Prabhu is now responding. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "My dear Rupa, please listen to me. It is not possible to describe devotional service completely. Therefore, I am just trying to give you a synopsis of the symptoms of devotional service." I think we can say this about any kind of love. You can never describe love completely. If you love somebody, you can never fully describe it. Text 137. The ocean of the transcendental mellow of devotional service is so big that no one can estimate its length and breadth. However, just to help you taste it, I am describing but one drop. So all that we get in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is just one drop of the understanding of the ocean of devotional service. And if you spent time studying Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, of course we have Srila Prabhupada's summary study as the Nectar Devotion, and now Bhanu Maharaj has translated the whole book, the verses and the commentary of Jiva Goswami and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. And you can see it's such an incredible science of love of God. I don't think you will find in any other religious philosophy of the world that they've analyzed love of God to that extent. Mostly they don't even have a good idea of what is God, what to speak of love of God. And yet that's just one drop. In an ocean of which you cannot estimate the length and the breadth. You know, in this world, it's not exactly like that, is it? When things get old, you kind of reach the limit of something. You learn about something, you become expert in it, and at a certain point it becomes boring. You need a new challenge. Those of you who are young, maybe you haven't experienced this, but you will. But with love of God, it's not like that. It's just one drop is so great that you can go on for lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes, and yet it has an ocean which you cannot estimate the length of the breath. Okay, now we're going to read text 38. Eta Brahmandabari Ananda. Eta Brahmandabari Ananta Jivagana. Charasi Lakshayanita Kareye Brahmana.
Charasi Lakshayanita Kareye Brahmana.
Eta Brahmandabari Ananta Jivagana.
Eta Brahmandabari Ananta Jivagana.
Charasi Lakshayanita Kareye Brahmana. karaye karaye brahmana
charashi lakshya vite karaye brahmana
ete brahmanda bari ananta jiva gana
ete brahmanda bari ananta jiva gana
Si lakshayo nite kare brahmana.
Si lakshayo nite kare brahmana.
Eita brahmanda bharyananta divagana.
Eita brahmanda bharyananta divagana.
Si lakshayo nite kare brahmana.
Si lakshayo nite kare brahmana.
Eita brahmanda bharyananta divagana.
Devotional service. He's going to start with describing the living entity. That's where he's going to start. At least one time, Prabhupada, in a conversation with devotees, said, if you're going to teach someone about Krishna consciousness, what do you start with? They said, I start with explaining that there's a God, that Krishna is a person. He said, no. Start with explaining that you're not this body. Start from self. Translation of purport by Srila Prabhupada. It's a long purport, so please don't fall asleep. I may ask you some questions afterwards. We should have some burpee here for whoever answers In this universe, there are limitless living entities in 8,400,000 species, and all are wandering within this universe. Ananta means what? Unlimited, anta means end, ananta, without end. So just in this one universe, in this Brahmanda, there's ananta living entities, you can't count them, and they're manifested in how many species? 8,400,000. Where does that number come from? 8,400,000. Yeah, it comes from the Bhagavata. What's the mathematics behind that number? Rephrase the question. Yes?
Srila Prabhupada mentions 3 by 3.
Yes.
It's 9. 9 nines, 81.
And then
for some reason, add on the original 3.
You add on the original 3 by themselves.
84.
And then you get 84. So that means that the 3 are the 3 what?
Modes.
So you take the 3 modes and you mix them with each other. And then you get 9. You take those 9, mix them with each other. 9 times 9. Remember this mathematics, right, from when you were little? Right. You get 81, and then the original 3 makes 84. So that means each species is a particular combination of the modes. Okay, that will be important as we're going on this purport to remember that. Also now, are each one, now within the species, we can also see that we're all different. Right? Everyone here is human. We're all human species, earth humans. But we're all different. There's so many varieties. You know, you can have subcategories. The first main subcategory is male and female. First question you ask when the baby's born, is it a boy or a girl? When I was expecting my second child, when I was that big, I said, you put on this over there.
And the temple president was told my husband that I was going to give birth to the whole movement. I used to cook for all of the gurus in ISKCON, and one of them was visiting before I had the baby, and they came afterwards, and his servant came to me and said, "Oh, Mataji, what kind of baby did you have?" I hope it was a human baby. So, you know, although we're generally human, then we're divided into male and female, then we're divided into different ethnicities, different races, different body types, and then go on and on and on and on and on and on until it's just us. Right? Even if you, like our Ras Mandala Prabhu here, has an identical twin brother, or some of you know Satyaraj? Any of you know the writer Satyaraj? His wife is one of identical triplets. So even then, still there's individuality, right? You don't have exactly the same DNA as your brother. Each body is a little different. And the differences in the bodies are due to the different combinations of modes. Okay? Now Prabhupada's also going to talk about the causes here for the different bodies. It might be nice to know why we got the body that we got. Because you kind of just wake up in it, and here I am. Now, how did I get here? But there's a reason why each of us have our particular body. And that might help us if we would like to, because we're not going to be in this body forever, right? Correct? Anybody planning on being in their present body forever? It won't work out. So where are we going to go after this body? Well, how did we get here? And maybe if we know how we got here, we can figure out where we'd really like to go. How would you go to here? Purport. Prabhupada's going to talk about two main points in this purport. This is a challenge to the so-called scientists and philosophers. Prabhupada likes challenges. The other day, one devotee told me he had a fighting nature. Prabhupada also. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati also. A challenge. This is a challenge to the so-called scientists and philosophers who presume that there are living entities on this planet only. So-called scientists, are going to the moon and they say that there is no life there. This does not tally with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's version. He says that within the universe there are unlimited numbers of living entities in 8,400,000 different forms. In Bhagavad Gita 2:24, we find that the living entities are sarva-gataha, which means they go everywhere. Gataha is a destination to go. This indicates that there are living entities everywhere. They exist on land, in water, in air, in fire, and in ether. Ether means space. Why should there be living entities on one planet and not others? Such a foolish version can never be accepted by Vedic students. In the Vedic literatures, we understand that there are living entities on each and every planet, regardless of whether the planet is composed of earth, water, fire, or ether. These living entities may not have the same forms that are found on this planet Earth, but they have different forms composed of different elements. So the scientists tell us, well, no one can live on Jupiter because the atmosphere of Jupiter won't support life. Well, it won't support Earth life. Or maybe it can support another kind of life. Even on this Earth, we can see that the forms of land animals are different from the forms of aquatics. According to the circumstance, living conditions differ, but undoubtedly there are living entities everywhere. Why should we deny the existence of living entities on this or that planet? So, of course, as Prabhupada says, these so-called scientists, why do they say that there's only living entities on this planet? Of course, not all of them say that. But those who do say that, what are their reasons? They haven't found any. Okay? Of course, they haven't gone very many places to look. But they haven't found any. And if they looked, if the living entities had very different forms, we might not be able to perceive them. In this room, there are so many living entities that none of us can perceive. Microscopic living entities, and there might be other kinds of living entities in this room that we cannot perceive, that are not microscopic. It's entirely possible. Why else do they say there's no living entities on any other planet? What's their reason?
Certain
okay, well that's assuming, again, they're assuming that living forms must be carbon-based like they are on this planet. They must be earth-based, basically. I mean, our bodies pretty much match the planet. The planet is what, like 60-70% water, and so are our bodies. You know, we have a body that matches our atmosphere of the planet. So it would be more logical to say that we have bodies that match the planet, and on other planets they would have bodies that match the planet. One of the main reasons they say that there's only life on this planet is that they're saying that life is just a chance combination of matter that is a one in a gazillion, billion, million chances of happening, and it's such a remote possibility of it happening at all that it couldn't have happened any other time than once. So that's one reason. Of course, there are many scientists who do say that there may be life on other planets, and of course there are many attempts to try to find life on other planets. There's the whole radio telescope thing where we're hoping that we'll get some signals from life on other planets. Those who have claimed to have gone to the moon have not gone there, or else their imperfect vision cannot actually perceive the particular type of living entities there. So here Prabhupada's giving two of a number of different responses that he has to the moon landing. So generally Prabhupada would say, they just didn't go there. That was his general response. Sometimes he said, well, maybe they went to another planet, such as Rahu. Or, here he's saying, they could have gone there, but they couldn't see what it really was. I mean, if someone says to me, oh yeah, I visited Radhadesh, and I say, oh, what did you think of the castle? And they say, castle? What castle? I didn't see any castle. Then you would automatically assume, what? That they didn't go to Radhadesh. So, Srila Prabhupada is saying that because those who went to the moon, they're not describing the moon as it's described in the scriptures, we decide that they haven't gone. Of course, for the scientists who take their sense perception as supreme, their conclusion is what?
There's nothing there.
Well, the scriptures say one thing, and they say they saw something else. So Prabhupada decides they didn't go. And the empiricists would decide what?
The scriptures are wrong.
That the scriptures are wrong. That the scriptures describe something. I went there, I looked around, it wasn't there. The scriptures must be wrong. So that, and then Prabhupada's saying, well, maybe they did go there, but they're not able to perceive the living entities there because they're more subtle. Not only more subtle, but they have the ability to decide to whom they want to show themselves. I mean, even some of these higher entities may walk around on this planet and may not always show themselves. Now, there are many, there's much empirical evidence that there are living entities on other planets. And our godbrother Sataputta Prabhu compiled his book, Alien Identities, which was a little controversial. Some devotees didn't like that book. I was recently at a book stall at one of our camps, and a devotee asked me, which of these books here are controversial, and I don't sell them anymore. But there were lots of them. So that book was a little controversial. Some people said, oh, you shouldn't write about beings on other planets. But Sataputta Prabhu presented a tremendous amount of empirical evidence that there are beings from other planets or beings from other dimensions, and that they interact with people on Earth. And they interact with people on Earth regularly from a very long time ago to the present. And that there's enough empirical evidence that denying it would mean that we have to deny practically all human testimony. And not only is it just human testimony, but sometimes there's concrete physical evidence that there's other beings interacting on Earth that are not within the list of known Earth species and appear to come from some other dimension. So there's quite a bit of empiric evidence. And of course, if we look in the traditional stories of all the cultures of the world, we'll find stories of interaction with beings from other planets or other dimensions. And not only in the traditional stories of the cultures, but of course if we look in all the religious literature of the world, we find people talking to angels or people talking to demigods. Right? There's interaction between human beings and other entities, or people interacting with demons. And again, that's not just in old books, but it's also something that's being experienced today. I mean, you can find many these stories, not only of people who've encountered spaceships with strange-looking creatures, but people who've encountered higher beings. I read one story about one professor and his wife who were taking a walk in the woods, and he said he never believed in religion or scripture or anything supernatural like that. He was a skeptic. And they heard some voices, and they thought, oh, there are some people walking behind us on the path in the woods. And the voices seemed to come up closer to them, but seemed to go above them. And all of a sudden, he and his wife looked up, and they saw that there were these celestial beings who were engaged in conversation with each other, passing over them. And, you know, the professor goes on a little further, and then he looks at his wife and said, can I ask you something? So there's many, many stories like this. I mean, and these are stories from very respectable people, very intelligent people, very sane people. And there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories like this. I mean, I heard that in Vrindavan somewhere, that there's one woman who's being revered as a saint because somebody was about to rob her. And she cried, "Hey, Radhe!" And she was immediately carried to the other side of the Jamuna River. And I thought, there's lots of stories. Ordinary people have stories like that. You know, they're in a car accident, and some person appears out of nowhere and just rescues them from the car. And all of a sudden, they're on the other side of the street. But when the people come to the ambulances and the doctors come, the car is locked. They can't get it open. So where's that person who sailed? There's nobody here. There's no footprints. There's so many stories like this. Again, there's this, the number of stories and the amount of physical evidence is so great that to say that the only life that exists is the life that we can immediately perceive with our senses that is on Earth, you really have to say that it's not even good science. Because good science would accept all data that can be independently verified. And of course, the main reason why this data is not accepted is explained by Kuhn in his book, Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which, if you haven't read that and you're an academic type, we have some academic types here, you probably need some study guide to understand it, but it's an excellent book. And he's the one who talked about the idea of paradigms. And he says that we get a paradigm, an idea of what's real and what's not, what's acceptable evidence, what's not, what's our worldview. And then all the evidence that we perceive has to fit in that paradigm. And if there's anomalous evidence, if there's evidence that doesn't fit the paradigm, you either try to squeeze it into the paradigm or you ignore it. Now, at a certain point, you understand what anomalous means? Doesn't fit. You know, if I decide, oh, Mr. Smith is very mean, he's a cruel person, and then Mr. Smith starts doing nice things for me and other people, and after a while, from the beginning, I'm just saying, oh, he's not really doing anything nice. Or he's just doing that because he wants something. But if the evidence mounts up over years, then I have to change my conception of what kind of a person Mr. Smith is, because his behavior doesn't fit my view. So a paradigm is your view, your filter. And then anomalous evidence doesn't fit. At a certain point, if the anomalous evidence mounts up, you have to change your filter. But Thomas Kuhn is saying that it's not that your filter of the world just gets bigger. What I was taught as a child is that scientists see part of the truth, and as more evidence comes, they see more, and as more evidence comes, they see more, and as more evidence comes, they see more. But Kuhn says this is not correct. That what happens is your view shifts. You say, oh, it's like this. You end up with two worldviews that are incompatible. And so you shift to see another part of reality. Once you do that, some of the things in your first paradigm become anomalous. That just through the senses and logic, you cannot get a worldview that encompasses everything. You just can't. You end up seeing certain parts, like those pictures where you can see either the faces or the vase, but not both. So that just scientific theories only allow you to see portions of reality. If you think of reality as a very complicated picture, so most of you can't easily see a picture. Can you see that picture of Radha Krishna? So it's a very complicated picture. Suppose you just look at a piece of it. You can describe a certain piece of it. But through the senses and logic, you can never see the whole thing. So you're just taking your vision from one place to another. So if you have a worldview that this body is a product of a chance combination of matter, if that's your worldview, and that can really only happen, I mean, mathematically, it can almost never happen. But if you say, well, that is what happened, and therefore it happened once, then within that worldview, accommodating the idea that it could have happened in another place, it's almost impossible. The idea that it happened even once is almost impossible, what to speak that it happened twice. Also, the worldview of evolution is that human beings, and particularly scientific human beings, are the pinnacle of evolution. They are practically God. And if you start admitting that there's beings on other planets, well, that might sort of shake up your idea that you're the top of the pile. One other thing I should mention about traditional literature and modern literature about beings from other planets. One friend of mine was telling me that there's some movie out about 2012 and an apocalypse. And I was thinking about all of the stories. When I was a kid, there was a story called War of the Worlds. Any of you remember that? It was by Orson Welles, right?
H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells.
Yeah, okay. So he described that the Martians came and took over the world. I remember reading that book. And when the book first came out, it was read on the radio. Do you all know about this? It was read on the radio, and at the beginning of the reading, they said, this is fiction. But as the reading was going on, they didn't keep interrupting him and saying, this is fiction. And people would turn on the radio, and they thought the Martians were actually coming. And there were huge traffic jams getting out of the cities, and it was a big thing. But human beings have these stories also of alien invasions, don't we? And I think that's a popular theme in the media. And of course, in the Bhagavatam, we do read about an alien invasion, an alien attack on the earth. Do you know what that is? It's briefly mentioned. It's very, very briefly mentioned. Although it's referred to quite a bit. When Shalva attacked Dwarka, and he also attacked with a huge spaceship, it said his attack on Dwarka was just like his airship was like a city. It was just like when the... We're supposed to be scholars here. When the three cities of the demons attacked the Earth planet. Remember now? Yes. Who destroyed those three cities?
Shiva.
And that's the story, right? They were again restored, and the demons were dipped in a lake of nectar, and then Krishna and Brahma came as a cow and a calf and drank up the nectar, and then the demons were finished. But they had three huge spaceships, like cities, and they were attacking the Earth. So they were demoniac beings from other planets that attacked the Earth. And the Earth was saved by Lord Shiva. And that's there in our history. And I often suspect that a lot of these stories, a lot of these fictional stories, are because we were there in some form. We remember. It's like we remember the universal cataclysms. Bhutva, 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 again and again and again destroyed. Prabhupada says we remember these destructions. We remember somewhere in our subconscious, we remember our deaths, we remember universal destructions. It's there in our collective memory. So we tell stories about it. So this is another little bit of, you could say, anecdotal evidence that these stories in the Shastra are valid. Why do people keep talking about it? Why does it keep coming up in popular fiction? The world was destroyed by some alien invasion. Because it happened. Living entities are described as ananta, or so now Prabhupada's going on to another point. So now first he's discussed the point that living entities are everywhere, all over the universe, they're on all the planets. Now he's going to a second point. Living entities are described as ananta, or unlimited. Nonetheless, they are said to belong to 8,400,000 species. As explained in the Vishnu Purana, Jalaja Navalakshani, Stavara Lakshavimshati, Krimayo Rudrasakaya, Pakshinam Dakshalakshinam, Trimsa Lakshani Pashava, Chakta Lakshanamanusaha. There are 900,000 species living in the water. There are also 2 million non-moving living entities, Stavara, such as trees and plants. There are also 1,100,000 species of insects and reptiles. And there are 1 million species of birds. As far as quadrupeds are concerned, there are 3 million varieties, and there are 400,000 human species. Some of these species may exist on one planet and not on another, but in any case, within all the planets of the universe and even in the sun, there are living entities. This is the verdict of the Vedic literature. As Bhagavad Gita 2.20 confirms, what's Bhagavad Gita 2.20? Bhagavad Gita 2.20? Bhakti Shastri people here? Or are a lot of Bhakti Shastri people on vacation? Na jayate miyate vakadachya nayam bhutva bhagata bhavana bhuyaha ajao nicha shasvita yam purano na hamite hanu mane shri vaya. And it means? Never birth, no death. Nor once been does he ever cease to be. He's unborn, eternal, ever existing, undying, primeval. He is not slain. In the body, he is slain. So you've got all these different species, and then you've got an eternal living entity. Since the living entities are never annihilated, they simply transmigrate from one life form to another. Thus, there is an evolution of forms according to the degree of developed consciousness. So why do we go in different bodies? Because of our degree of consciousness. And the bodies, remember, are formed of different combinations of the modes. One experiences different degrees of consciousness in different forms. A dog's consciousness is different from a man's. Even within a species, we find that a father's consciousness is different from his son's, and that a child's consciousness is different from a youth's. Just as we find different forms, we find different states of consciousness. So each form facilitates different consciousness, different states of consciousness. When we see different states of consciousness, we may take it for granted that the bodies are different. In other words, different types of bodies depend on different states of consciousness. This is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 8.6. What's Bhagavad Gita 8.6? Yam yam bhavisram bhavam torta jante kalima. Prabhupada discourse the first one. One consciousness at the time of death determines a type of body of a living entity. This is the process of transmigration of the soul. A variety of bodies is already there. We change from one body to another in terms of our consciousness. In this universe, there are limitless living entities and 8,400,000 species, and all are wandering within this universe. Why is Lord Chaitanya talking about this as he starts talking about devotional service? He's going to go on for several verses explaining about. Okay, well, very good reason, because it's a small chance. Therefore, we should value it. If you enter some contest, now my son was asking me this the other day. Does Mata, do you ever enter any contest to win anything? You know, sometimes the airlines, they send you an email, enter this contest, you can win a free trip. So if you win a contest, the only thing I ever won in a contest was cat food. When I was a kid. So if you enter a contest and you win and the chances are only 1 out of 3 billion, you're so excited. That's why people get excited when they win the lottery. Wow, such a rare thing, so valuable. Of course, the research shows they don't stay excited. That when you win the lottery, you're only happier for 6 months at most, and then you go right back to your previous level of happiness. Or lower. Because now all your friends are envious of you. So we value it. So we say this devotional service is very valuable. This human form of life, Duralabha Manava Janma. Take it seriously. What's another reason why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was starting with a description of the jiva?
If you want to go somewhere, you have to know where you are.
Yeah, if you want to go somewhere, you have to know who you are. And where you are. And it might be a good idea to know why you're where you are. So why are we in this body? Right? We're all walking around every day in this machine. Now sometimes with medicine, doctors do surgery through robots. Are you aware of that? Sometimes they can even do surgery from another city. If you have a specialist who's the only one who can do a certain operation, they can hook him up to a robot in another city and he can do the surgery. So they're hooked up to some robot and they can cut somebody open and take out this organ and do this through robotic hands. Well, that's what we're all doing all the time. We're inside basically a very clever robot and we're operating it. So how did we get yantra rudanimaya? We're on a yantra. We're sitting on a machine. So how did we get this particular machine? That might be a good thing to know. Because as Prabhupada's quoting here, that according to what we think of, that depends what machine we get next. And not only what we think of, what we've done. Combination of our actions and our thoughts, our desires. So how did I get this particular machine? It's according to, what does Prabhupada say here? According to my level of consciousness. Remember we were talking about the scientists, how they can never see the whole picture? They can only see just part of the picture. And also that how you interpret reality, truth, how you interpret truth, depends on your desires, doesn't it? Whether you interpret something as food or not food, or something as good or bad, as desirable or undesirable, depends on your frame of reference. I walked past the horse this morning. Whenever I walk past the horse comes up to me. So this morning I picked some grass. But if I gave any of you grass, you wouldn't be happy. The horse was very happy and continued to follow me. So what you see as food, what we see as desirable, what we see as good or bad, how we evaluate. In education, we have what's called Bloom's taxonomy, where first you know something, then you understand something, then you analyze something, then you can synthesize something, and finally you evaluate something. Is this good or bad? What's the purpose of knowing something and understanding something and analyzing something and synthesize something? If you don't know, is this something that I want or something that I don't want? And that's the ultimate function of the mind also. Is it good or bad? So how do we decide that? We decide that by our filters. What's filtering? The horse has a particular combination of the modes, a particular body over that soul, and that body says grass is food. And my filter of the mode says grass is not food. So his filter says it's good and my filter says it's bad. So who's seeing truth, the horse or me? Neither. Neither of us is seeing truth. We're each seeing, like the scientists looking at a little picture, we're each seeing a little piece of truth through our own filter. And I have a general human filter. If we find humans that don't act according to their human filter, we consider them psychotic or we consider them criminal. Right? If a human being sees other humans as food, for example, if their conceptions of what's right and wrong according to human life is very different. So I have a human filter, then I have my gender filter, I have my cultural filter, and I have my particular filter, my little individual filter of what's good and bad. And my ideas of what I wanted is what gave me this filter. I want to enjoy certain things. Therefore, I get a body that is suited to enjoy those things. That's basically how it works. I want to have certain sense objects as my enjoyable objects. So then I get a machine that fits those objects. Does that make sense? Everybody understand that? Like you want to go skiing, you buy skis. You want to go scuba diving, you buy a wetsuit. You want to go gardening, you buy old blue jeans. You get a particular set of equipment or clothes that allow you to enjoy in that particular way. You wouldn't play tennis with skis on. It wouldn't work. Right? So we have desires. I want to enjoy the world. Let me taste this. Let me taste this. Let me taste this. Let me taste this. What's it like to just run in the fields with my hair flowing behind me? Live in nature. Be a horse. If that's how you want to enjoy, then you get the suitable body. Eka bhavanam yogadadati kama. Krishna is fulfilling all the desires of the living entity. And along with that body, you get a particular filter that you start seeing that is enjoyable. Of course, what happens once we're in the body? If we have a little bit of intelligence, we start saying, oh, this is not very enjoyable. I thought I would enjoy by having this particular set of sense objects. but it's not working out. And then what does the conditioned soul generally do? Let me try another set of sense objects. This particular set isn't working out. Let me try another set. It's not so nice being a man. Maybe I can be a woman. It's not so nice being a human. Maybe I can be a horse. Maybe I can be a fish. Maybe I can be an angel, a demigod. Maybe I can be a demon. I mean, you've got people today, maybe you've seen them, who are practicing to be demons. Have you seen them?
Yeah.
Definitely, I've seen them. I've seen them especially in London. And when I go to the Woodstock Festival in Poland. I see people who have, they've even modified their bodies. Do you know that that's happening? That people are putting like silicone under their bodies to create horns and, yeah, they do. Actually do that. And they pierce their bodies so it looks like they have fangs, and sometimes they tattoo things on their bodies so they look like monsters. Well, let me try that taste. What does it taste like to be a monster? What does it taste like to be a demigod? What does it taste like to be a fish? What does it taste like to be a bird, to be a horse, to be a cow, to be a female human, to be a male human, to be a Chinese human, to be a... And we're trying all these different tastes, but they're really just chewing the chew. It's really basically the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. But it looks different. The Bhagavatam explains it's like a prostitute who changes her clothes. She's the same prostitute, but she's got different clothes on. Oh, now it's different today. So we're thinking, oh, now it's different. Horse enjoyment will be different. Demigod enjoyment will be different. But it's not. It's basically the same thing. What is it? It's just simply combining my senses with their objects, taking my robot arm, which is not even me, and combining it with its object. And I'm just witnessing. I have nothing to do with this. And it's just, what does Krishna say? Mental concoction. All sense enjoyment is mental concoction. Oh, I must be enjoying this. But I'm not. I'm just witnessing it. It's all just electricity in the brain that I'm interpreting according to my filter as this is nice and this is not nice. That's all it is. And it's nothing more than that. It's just the three modes of nature combining, and as they combine in different ways, I think, oh, that's new. That's a new combination I haven't seen before. So some living entities go through all 8,400,000 species again and again and again and again, and each species they try a little different varieties again and again and again. And at a certain point, a living entity may say, there's something wrong with the whole concept here. The whole thing is wrong. Let me look for something else. So, of course, that isn't covered in this purport, but as we go on, we see, what is the something else? Who am I? What is my enjoyment? What is my real enjoyment that will actually satisfy me? And my real enjoyment is not trying to exploit the world through a variety of machines. My real enjoyment is a loving relationship with my origin. So that's one concludes that. It's not, I don't want to just change from one material position to another. I don't want any more material positions. So, okay, now in this life, I'm still in this machine. I have to use this machine. It's not that when you decide to be Krishna conscious immediately, you know you're out of your body. Yes, I want to love Krishna. Okay. Of course, it is all based on desire. Perhaps it's all desire. It says that in the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it's all desire. So once the desire is strong enough, then even in this body, as we were reading the other day, Jiva Mukta, one no longer is experiencing one's pleasure from the situation of the machine, and one is really living in a different reality. One's level of consciousness, even within the body, has gone beyond the body. Until we're at that point, our bodies, I've gotten this body because I had a certain level of consciousness, and this body also restricts my consciousness. But when one falls in love with Krishna, even within this body, the body can no longer serve to restrict one's consciousness. One's consciousness of reality, of truth, one's experience, no longer has anything to do with the body, even while one is in the body. Although still, you have to use the body. You can't pretend you have a different body, even when you're liberated. You can't say, now I'm liberated, I'm going to live like a fish. That doesn't work. So that's what we should be inquiring. Adatto Brahma Jikyasa. We should be asking, now that we have this human body and our consciousness is developed enough, the horse cannot say, was this really a good idea of yours? It doesn't have that, its level of consciousness and the filter of the body is so dense that it can't ask that question. We can ask that question. Was it really a good idea to be a human being? Was that really a good idea to get a human body and be in the material world? So we're going to just very briefly look at the two personalities whose disappearance state is today and see what kind of life that they were living. You see, Gadadhar Pandit, who of course is not an ordinary living entity at all, he's Radharani, who comes with Krishna as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to assist him in understanding spiritual love and teaching spiritual love. Because just to say that the material world doesn't make it isn't enough. You have to know something about the reality. So Krishna came as Lord Chaitanya to show, here's the reality. This exchange of real love, not the exploitation that is called love in this world, but real love. And Gadadhar Pandit was showing that, and particularly because we're saying that we get these bodies according to our desires and our consciousness, he shows what is spiritual desire. Because we may think, well, spiritual just means no desire. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was leaving Jagannath Puri to preach, and Gadadhar Pandit wanted to come with him. And Lord Chaitanya said, yes, come with me, right? What did he say? He said, no, I don't want you to come with me. Just yesterday, somebody emailed me. How do I find out just what Krishna wants? You know, sometimes we think that the living entity is supposed to be a blank slate, and we just go to Krishna. Krishna, just tell me what you want, please, and I will just do whatever you say. That's not a loving relationship, actually. It really isn't. And none of us really want to have a lot of people in our lives who are dealing with us like that, do we? Would you like all of your intimate friends and family members to be like that with you? I am reporting for duty. What would you like me to do today? I will just do whatever you want. I have no personality and no desires and no interests at all. Just whatever you say, I will do. It might be nice to have one or two people like that as slaves. Come candy sometimes. But you really wouldn't want your intimate associates to be like that. Right? I mean, even having slaves, after a while you feel kind of bad, wouldn't you? That's just for us. And we're just conditioned souls full of exploitation, and what to speak of God who's not exploited. So that's not what he's interested in. Of course, Prabhupada says that the devotees have no desires to fulfill because they're fully Atmaramanat to come. But still they have desires in service. So Gadadhar Pandit said, I don't want to do what you're saying, Lord. I want to come with you. Is that interesting? He said, I want to come with you. Lord Chaitanya said, no. And Gadadhar Pandit said, yes. And Lord Chaitanya said, no. And Gadadhar Pandit said, yes. And he went anyway. He went anyway. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would say, stop this. Go back. You've taken a vow that you'll never leave Jagannath Puri. I want my devotees to be respected. It's truthful. If you break your vows, then nobody will respect my devotees anymore. Go back. He said, no. And Gadadhar Pandit would travel on a little different path, and then he'd meet up in the evening. And finally, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, okay, look, you broke your vow already. You've gone far enough. Please, now, go. Finally, Gadadhar Pandit went. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu got in a boat. Gadadhar Pandit was left on the shore. He couldn't find another alternate route to follow, and he went back. And we see this relationship between the desire of the Lord and the desire of the devotees. Of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was actually very happy that Gadadhar Pandit loved him enough to break his vow and to follow him. You know, if you really love somebody, I don't know if any of you have ever been in love, but if you've ever been in love, you don't want the person out of your sight even for a moment. And you just want to be with them all the time. Of course, after a while in this world, that gets old. But the initial infatuation You always want to think about them, you always want to see them, you always want to be with them. The thought that they're going to go to another place and leave you is unbearable. So Gadadhara Pandit showing us this desire of the devotee. So it's not just that we stop desiring to enjoy through the machines of this world. We start desiring a loving relationship with Krishna. And we can start that now. Now we can have desires now. It really is okay to have desires now. It really is. It's okay. In fact, you can't not have desires. It's impossible. You can't just say, okay, all my material desires, like the Buddhist, all my material desires have caused me problems. No more desires. You can try it. You can try it. The results are not very pretty. If you try. You'll become hard-hearted, angry, or after a while, all those desires will explode like a volcano, and that will be kind of ugly too. So that doesn't work. Please don't do that. Please don't do that. What you can do is we cultivate spiritual desires. And you can say, well, my desires now are not fully spiritual. That's okay. It's a beginning. I have spiritual desires, just like Prabhupada said, that he wanted us to have accredited college courses. So some devotees said, I'd like to do that. Now, Prabhupada had a whole list of all the things that he'd like to do. And you can say, I'd like to do that. Prabhupada wants us to have wonderful deity worship. Oh, I'd like to do that. Prabhupada wants us to distribute books. Well, I'd like to do that. He wants us to clean the temple. Well, I'd like to do that. And we have desires in spiritual service. And Krishna's already said, these are all the things that I like. And Prabhupada said, these are all the things that I want. Okay, what would you like to do? And you can discuss with your guru, with your authority. What do you think? Can I do this? And then they might say, yeah, that's a great idea. I don't know. I don't know if that will really work out for you. Is there something else you want? Express your desires. And when you do that, something magical happens, and then we'll turn to Bhakti Vinod Thakur. So Bhakti Vinod Thakur in Jivadharma talks about why we suffer. And it's not exactly that the reason we're suffering is because we have a material body and mind and we're in the material world. And that I have to go to a different place. It's not exactly that I have to leave my body and travel to a different place in order to be happy. I was recently at a festival where one of the leaders said, we have some service that needs to be done. Anyone who'd like to go back to Godhead can sign up. Oh, we don't mean right now. And I was thinking, why wouldn't we want to go back to Godhead right now? You know, we have this concept that going back to Godhead means I have to die. The body has to die. So if you want to go back to Godhead, you can do this service. Oh, I don't mean going back to Godhead right now. So how can we come back to Godhead? Prabhupada gives us the secret of how we can experience our birthright of unlimited happiness, anandam buddhivardhana. Even while in this body. Explains this in Jivadharma, I think it's chapter 25. He says that this material world is also one of the pastimes of the Lord. Creating this world, maintaining this world. And in all of Krishna's pastimes, there's things that are challenges, there's things that from an external point of view seem difficult. The Govardhan Hill pastime, there was a flood. There was rain like arrows. And there may be difficulties. But the devotees take all those difficulties as their pleasure. It's part of Krishna's adventure. It's part of Krishna's pastime. Just like we take pleasure in our sacrifices, don't we? Take pleasure in our sacrifices. We like to think about them. We like to talk about them. We don't only take pleasure in our accomplishments. And in the good times, we actually take pleasure in our sacrifices. Yeah, I did this. One of my proofreaders wrote me an email yesterday. I worked for 1 hour on this one page. He's relishing this. It's tapasya. It's interesting because tapa can literally mean suffering. The word tapa can use either for austerity or suffering. But when you voluntarily take some difficulty for something you love and something worthy, That's a source of great satisfaction. When to speak if you take some difficulty for the supreme lovable person. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, in this world also, there may be difficulties, but if they're taken as part of Krishna's pastime, then they become only pleasure. And he said, it's up to the jiva whether he wants to join that pastime. If he wants to find out his exuberance in being part of Krishna's pastime. If he wants to see, how am I Krishna's instrument? He said, if he doesn't choose to, if he sees his life as separate from Krishna and sees himself as separate from Krishna, he said, that distress is his own fault and can't be blamed on Krishna. So even in our present life, I can see, how is my life connected with Krishna? How is Krishna acting through me? How am I Krishna's instrument? How is Krishna around me in the world? What to speak of, if you're a card-carrying member of the Hare Krishna movement, then you know you're part of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. They're happening now. It's not just you have to go to another planet. That's what we're thinking. Oh, I've got to go here, I've got to go there. Just like materially, one is thinking to enjoy, I've got to go here, I've got to, maybe if I had this body, maybe if I lived in this country, maybe if I had this was in this ashram, maybe if I just changed somehow what machine I have or where it's located, then I'll be happy. And we can think like that in spiritual life too. Oh, if I was in the spiritual world, then I'd be happy. No, it's a matter of changing our consciousness now. How is Krishna working through me now? How is what I'm doing part of Krishna's story? Krishna likes reading the story of his devotees. You know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Gadadhar Pandit would read the story of Dhruva Maharaj over and over and over and over and over again. Why do we think they don't want to read our stories? It's hard to find somebody in this world who wants to read our story, isn't it? Even you talk to your best friends and your family members and you tell them what you did yesterday and they're only interested for a couple of minutes. But Krishna's really interested to know, what are my devotees doing? That's his pleasure. And what our business is to make a story that he'd really like to read. That's our business. And Krishna would like to talk about our life with his associates and what we're doing, just like he talked about Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj didn't start out as a pure devotee. He went to Krishna for money. And still, Krishna likes to read his story over and over and over again. His story is part of Krishna's story, and it's there in the time. So we can all do that too. Don't think, oh, Dhruva's up there, and I'm just, you know, we can all do that too. And then we no longer wander from one machine to another. We no longer are in this miserable existence. We can express fully our spiritual desires and spiritual individuality, and we will become completely fulfilled. So this is the message from the lives of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Gadadhar Pandit, and this instruction of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So I've gone till 9 o'clock. And I lost some people along the way. We can end now. And if you want to ask questions, you can stay, but the class is officially over. So thank you very much. All glories to Shri. I'll hang around another 10-15 minutes. If anybody wants to stay and discuss anything, that's fine. But the class is over. So you are welcome to leave and go about your daily business. Yes, Rudy.
I was wondering, the idea is, it's clearly mentioned in Bhagavad Gita what the soul does not do. Prakriti, kriyamana,
evil. The soul is not the doer.
Exactly. But how's the soul like to do this? Which I understood you said the soul is desiring.
The soul has desires, yes.
Is this scripture being mentioned somewhere? That's what the scripture.
That's a very good question. And there was a detailed discussion of this question on the email conference for ISKCON scholars. That one of the scholars was asking for very specific scriptural references like that. And we came up with, I have to go back to my computer and look up with all of the quotes that we came up with, but we didn't come up with something that hit the nail right on the head that was exactly what they were looking for. But if you'd like, I can go back to that, to those emails and look up all the specific quotes. But we were having a hard time finding
any idea of what Bhagavad Gita says.
Exactly, I'd have to look it up again.
Bhagavad Gita? Somewhere?
Well, in Bhagavad Gita, in the 15th chapter, it says that you get a set of sense objects grouped around the mind. And of course, you know, 8th chapter, Krishna's talking about how everything is due to our desires and our thoughts. And then Krishna's explaining the whole process of devotional service as one of thinking of him. Mamana Bhagavata, which he repeats twice, Maya Shaktamana Partha, whatever you're attached to, whatever you think about. So the concept of whatever you're attached to and whatever you think about determines your destination is certainly repeated many times in the Bhagavad Gita. But something very specific in the Sanskrit sloka that says the only thing the soul can do is desire. We couldn't find something that was word for word.
Could it be that we are Satchitananda and getting back to our authentic?
Of course we're Satchitananda.
Just a force. I mean, and if we are not Ananda, then the force is automatically dead.
I'm sorry, I'm not able to follow.
That our authentic position is yes. Satchitananda. So
correct.
We are eternal bliss.
Yes.
And if it is not experienced like that, that automatically, in one way or another,
it's false.
We tend back to pure bliss and pure happiness.
That we're trying to go back to.
Which could be translated as being desire, but just is a natural thing.
Yes, I would agree with you. Now you see that to do that though, you had to interpret. So it's implicit. I mean, the direct statements you're going to get are things like, if you're attached to me, if you think of me, you'll come to me. Whatever you think about, that's where you'll go. So there's, and then of course there's all the descriptions of perfected souls who have desires. And so, but it's implicit. At least we couldn't find anywhere where it was explicitly stated exactly in those words. As far as verses, I mean, if you're looking at commentary and purports, it's there abundantly. If you're looking at the slokas, it's more implicit. That was our conclusion.
I hate to miss that while you're talking about the different species of life, because this one place, it's something that puzzled me. Maybe you could shed some light or something. But there's one place where Prabhupada says, talks about the different species of life, and he says that Buddhists are a species. So
I have no idea. I have no light to shed on that. Because I don't know. I have no idea.
I thought it was an interesting. Because
it sounds interesting. I'd like to see the context.
Oh, I don't know that. But
I mean, that's another. If you want to know of another discussion that's taking place on the scholars' conference, is how do we define the 400,000 human species?
Yeah.
And again, I can't give you anything definitive. I'm now talking like an academic. So I can't give you something, you know, say absolutely this is what Shastra means by 400,000 human species.
I thought it was an interesting definition because it's not according, you know, it's not because you're brown or white or...
Well, but that's not, but we, see, we also had a big discussion about this on the Back to Godhead staff. Our issue last December was about evolution. And one of the authors wrote an article on evolution of consciousness, and he was talking about the human species, and we finally just took that paragraph out of the article.
Uh-huh.
There were too many different interpretations and too many, you know, it was too nebulous. My own understanding is it does refer to different types of body. So that the, I mean, sometimes Prabhupada talks about the higher demigods as being human species. And there's no separate list of species for the devas. So you've got, and not only the higher devas, but what we would call the lower devas, where the demoniac beings who live on other planets, the bhutas and the pisachas, those entities, the ghosts and hobgoblins and demons, and those are also varieties of species. And if you think about like Ravana, you know, they refer to themselves as a demoniac species. And their bodies were different from ours. They had naturalistic powers, for example. So that's my understanding.
What's the difference then between species and race? Is it the
You're asking questions to which I don't know of anybody who has an answer to.
But they're not necessarily the same.
You are asking questions that I don't know the answer, and I don't even know of anybody else who has a definitive, absolutely authoritative, I can back this up with a scriptural quote answer. I mean, I'm sure there's somebody who has an answer. But I don't know if they're walking around on this planet right now.
Are there people who speculate?
There's many people who speculate on it, yes.
So interesting.
their speculations are based on Shastra. I'm not going to sit here and tell you something authoritative because I don't know of anything authoritative. I mean, if you could go talk to Indra or Brahma, I'm sure they could give you something authoritative. Indra or Brahma.
Oh,
yeah. I'm sure they could tell you something authoritative.
I was waiting for that.
It's not clear. I mean, what we can say are that the other human-like species described in the Shastra, that in this list from the Vishnu Purana the Prabhupada's quoting, they don't have their own category. So the Shastra is describing there's all these different categories, okay? And there's all these beings described in the Shastra that don't have a separate category in that list other than the 400,000 human beings. So it's reasonable to extrapolate that those entities are some of the 400,000 races of human beings, so those are the species of human beings. Now, what exactly did the Shastra mean by species? Does that correlate to what modern science means by species? I don't know. And I don't know anybody else who knows either.
Because that's the thing, why I'm thinking, because
a lot of times I could say, oh, you could just ask somebody else. I don't even know to whom I could refer you.
But the way, because they say, well, we say there's 8,400,000 and they give a different number. But the way that they define a species is...
Well, we're dealing with two things. That first of all, that's how many species are in the universe. Chaitanya is using the word Brahmanda. Is in the universe. He didn't say that's how many species are on this planet.
But they might have more, because they keep finding these species.
And the other thing is that how you define species. It's just like element. So the scientists define an element as something that still has the same identity at the atomic level. That's their definition of element. And the Shastra's definition of element corresponds to the scientist's words, states of matter. So states of matter are solids, liquids, and gases. And that's what corresponds to what Bhagavatam is calling elements. Earth, which is solids, liquid, which is water, gases, which is air. Then fire is radiant energy, and space is space. You can't, ether is space. You can't have any of the, you can't have solid liquids or gases that don't exist within space. And, you know, there's no space in the spiritual world. Space is one of the first things created in this world. Space and time. So our conceptions of space and time only apply to this world. But anyway, my point is that we're using the English word elements. Of course, the Shastra is not written in English. So we're taking a word in the Shastra and we're translating it as elements. And elements in science means something that retains its identity on the atomic level. But that's not what the Sanskrit word that we're translating as elements refers to at all. It's referring to states of matter. It's referring to something entirely different. So the Sanskrit word that we're translating as species may not correlate to what the scientists mean by species. You're having a language problem here to some extent. So you're having a translation language problem. And then, yeah, not all the species are on this planet.
What's the word
then? I don't know. Look it up here. You want me to look it up again? We just read it in the verse today. Here's my glasses. We'll look it up. And then probably that word, just like Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada translate rasa as mellow. That's a really odd translation. I mean, when I say mellow, I mean somebody who's really kind of calm and peaceful. I don't mean a relationship. So we also have the problem that different words may change their meaning at different times. And Prabhupada said there is no real English equivalent for rasa. He says there's no English equivalent for rasa. I don't know how to translate this word, so I'm using Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's word.
It's like flavor.
Well, that's a real stretch of the definition of the word. That's not how we usually use it in English. You wouldn't say, what mellow does this ice cream have? That's you're stretching. Okay. Well, no, we don't have a word here. All you have is a number. There's no word for species. It's just a number. So there's just 900,000 live in the water. Jalaja means live in the water. Navalakshani means 900,000. So Jalada Navalakshani just means there are 900,000 born in the water. That's all. There's no word for species. So the word for species is implied. kinds isn't quite, it's not here. Pakshinam dasra lakshana. Pakshinam means birds. So it's not. Yeah. Chatur lakshani manushaha. Chatur lakshani means 400,000. Manushana means man. Means. So there's the word for kinds or species is completely absent. You're saying 400,000 humans, 900,000 water creatures, 2 million non-moving. And Prabhupada is inserting the word species so that we can say it in English. And then you're looking at what modern scientists call species. You know, even the scientists sometimes have difficulty in defining what is a species and what is a subspecies, and they have certain creatures that fit in more than one category, and certain creatures like the duck-billed platypus that hardly fit in any category. And so even they have difficulty when they talk about kinds. And the Christians who try to defeat evolution get into discussion about this. What do we define as a kind? Because the Bible says everything's created according to its kind. How do you define a species? In logic, there's a kind of illogical argument called victory by definition. I win the argument by changing the definition. You probably know about this. I win the argument by changing the definition of the word that we're using. So that doesn't bring you any closer to truth. So we're dealing with something where we have a translation problem. And we have a problem that we can't see all the species. I mean, it was just on one devotee news site, it talked about how there was a fossilized jaw of a huge aquatic creature that was found a couple years ago that fits the description of the Timangima fish that could swallow whales. I know this creature had jaws big enough, and even the scientists are saying this creature probably ate whales. Each tooth was about this long. Each tooth was 14 inches long. They said it's the biggest teeth they've ever seen, the biggest functional eating teeth other than like elephant's tusks and walrus tusks that have ever been seen on any creature. And the creature was several times bigger than the largest existing whale. So the scientists said, well, this creature is extinct. Do we really know? I mean, you can't go down in the Mariana Trench and look and see what's down there. You can only go down so far in a submersible. And then even human beings can't go down to the deepest depths. They can send down some cameras. And then you're just taking a picture of whatever happens to be around your camera. I mean, even to say that all the dinosaurs are extinct, how do you know? There's vast unexplored areas of the planet. I mean, you don't know. And every once in a while, they find a creature that, you know, usually a dead one, that they say, oh, maybe they weren't extinct. There was that fish. What was it called? I forget. Starts with a C, that they thought was extinct, and then they found it. Some prehistoric fish, yeah. So they may not see all the species. They're not all on this planet, and they have their own. Okay, we can take one more question, and then. Anything else anybody wanted to ask? So for all the questions that we wanted to, I really couldn't answer. Yes?
Prabhupada many times said that don't worry, once you come to Krishna Loka, you will never fall down.
Oh, this is the day for difficult questions. I should have walked out of the room at 9 o'clock instead of continuing to sit here. Yeah,
so,
okay.
But if we are never without desire, how come can be said that we will never fall down?
Well, when Prabhupada was asked that question, he said that means practically never. The possibility is always there. When Prabhupada was directly asked that question. So, I mean, I think one problem when looking at the Shastra is trying to understand everything literally, which you can't do anyway, because if you understand literally, you'll find contradictions. And just like we don't speak literally, well, neither do the great sages. And they don't write the scriptures. Even Krishna doesn't speak thinking that we're going to examine his words like a legal document. You know, that's just not the way they... Even lawyers, right? You don't speak to your friends like a legal document. I'm going to give, bequeath, and render this
present to you. You know, you just don't deal like that, which of course leads to some misunderstandings. But so we use absolutes. You know, I asked somebody the other day, I said, why does so-and-so das never come to the temple? And the person first answered me, and they said, well, he actually comes on Janmashtami. But you might say that. You know, you might say, well, somebody always comes to Mangal Arati. Well, not if they're out of town. Do you really mean always? Just think about it. Think about the, my mother used to say never, you know, kind of thing. If you think about the time that we use absolute general terms, and how often do we mean the absolute as absolutes, it's extremely unusual that when we say an absolute, we mean it in an absolute fashion. We usually mean it in a general fashion. And the Shastra is the same way. Not that we're all people. You don't always say, well, you never fall down. Of course, there is the possibility that you could if you really wanted to. I think we can safely assume that it doesn't happen. After coming here and going through all the species, would you do it again? I've also thought about it, about this basically this promise of Krishna that you won't fall. There was some... I was just hearing in a lecture where Prabhupada is saying that if you want to enjoy the material world, that Krishna doesn't want you to do it, and it's only if you insist. He said, just like if the child says, I really want to touch the fire, I really want to touch the fire, I really want to touch the fire. He said, no parent will just say, sure, go touch the fire. But if the child's insisting, you may try to give some experience that won't really hurt them. Like Prabhupada did with his 2-year-old child. He said his 2-year-old child wanted to touch the fan. In India in those days, the fans didn't have grates over them. You know, the safety features we take for granted in our modern society are fairly recent. So his 2-year-old wanted to touch the fan. He said, no. And finally, when it was really a botheration. He was asking all the time. And then one of Prabhupada's friends said, slow down the speed and then let him touch it. And then he said to his child, touch again? The child said, no. So Krishna is fulfilling our material desires in a way that we're not really getting hurt. We're not really experiencing any of this stuff that we're going through. So none of it's affecting us at all. We're not getting hurt in the slightest. There's no damage being done to us. But we're imagining that we're having all these experiences. So it's just like, you know, your kid wants to touch the fire, you let them touch something that's hot enough so that they understand what heat is, but not hot enough to hurt them. That's exactly what Krishna's doing. He said, okay, this is what it's like if you want to try to be an independent God and you want to be the center and you don't, you know, you want to exploit instead of love. This is what it's like. So we had to insist. So are you going to insist again? Yeah, you can. It's not that you lose the ability to. I mean, one of the first things little children learn, one of the first words a little child learns is hot. One of the first words that they learn is hot. And once they've had one experience, the rest of your life, you never again willfully get burned. I mean, unless you're running into a burning building to save somebody's life, you know, unless there's some higher principle, but you're not going to willfully get burned. So sometimes the great devotees come in this world to save the living entities. Sometimes they run into a burning fire to save the nityasiddhas may come for that reason. But otherwise, why would you ever do it again? And also, I see that Krishna in this is just my own conclusion, that one of the reasons... Actually, it's based on some things that Prabhupada says, that Krishna wants to see how serious we are. But I also see it that if Krishna's going to make a promise that we won't come back again, he wants to make sure that we're really on solid ground. You know, if I just say, oh, Krishna, okay, I'd like to love you, I want to go back to the spiritual world, I'm tired of material life. How deep is that? If immediately he removed all the coverings that we asked for, would we really be able to maintain that? Probably not.
So we come to a point of maturity. I was just reading that in, I think it was Sridhar Swami's commentary on a verse in the Bhagavad Gita. I can't remember which verse. And he said, as soon as you chant Hare Krishna one time without offense, which happens if someone just says, oh, look at those funny Hare Krishnas over there, then immediately your Prarabdha karma is gone and your body is your Prarabdha karma. He said, so why don't you just immediately get out of your body? He said, because your devotional service needs to mature. And my own analogies for this are, if somebody's been a drug addict, and we're all basically drug addicts is what we are, we're addicted to finding happiness through connecting our machine with its objects, which is a kind of drug. It's an addiction. And when you're a drug addict, if when you say, okay, I want to become sober, that saying, I want to become sober, it doesn't mean that you're immediately going to be able to do it. It may take several tries, and it takes a lot of determination. You know, and if you had an alcoholic or a drug-addicted spouse and they were stealing all your money and wrecking your things and hitting you, and if they came and said, okay, I want to become sober, you wouldn't necessarily that minute restore the relationship 100%. And part of that is you want to make sure that they're really solid. You'd say, oh, that's great. You know, I'm so happy. And then you help them go through a program where they can make that determination to be something that they're not going to break again, that it's going to be solid. And I see this whole process of sadhana bhakti and the whole way that Krishna's dealing with us is to get to the point that it's rock solid. That it's just like, okay, I definitely want you and I want to love you and I don't want to try to enjoy this other way anymore. It's just, there's no question. It's total. And then when it's total, okay, now you don't need this illusory thing you asked for anymore, we'll take it. Is that all right? I should definitely stop here. Thank you very much.